song of encouragement after the lesson will be 329.
At some point late last week, sometime after Wednesday, I suppose, it became evident from the announcements that were being made that we were going to have something of an intimate day here together. See, I could have said small, but I didn't. I said intimate. You turn a negative into a positive. And so I decided to do something a little different than I had planned. Lots of times in situations like this, when we have a lot of our members out, I'm not sure exactly why my mind thinks this way, but I look for passages of the Bible to just talk about for a little bit. And sometimes I will do what I call a random Bible read. And I've talked to the young people about this, the different ways of studying the Bible. One way that I study the Bible sometimes is just open up the Bible and read what I find, with no plan at all. And it's remarkable how many times you do that and you find something that really resonates. You find something that, well, I say it's remarkable. You'd open the Bible to any passage, I suppose, that you wanted to and find something that would resonate. But lots of times you find something that's particularly applicable or makes a point that you hadn't really thought about. And I'm not going to go so far as to say God guides me to a particular page or whatever. I'm not going to say he doesn't either. God does whatever he wants to do. But I will say this, that I opened my Bible up randomly in the last 4 or 5 days and happened to open up to Isaiah chapter 46, or at least an opening that has Isaiah 46 on it. And I started reading in this passage, and I said, I want to talk a little bit about this. And what's going on with the people of Israel during Isaiah's time and what was going to go through their lives in coming days and years. Pardon me, I got a bit of it too. And make some applications for us. And basically just dig into the text a little bit and study what the Bible says on this subject. Now let me give you a little bit of a background here. When Isaiah is writing here, he is writing in preparation for a time of captivity that's going to be coming in the not too, well, 100 years or so in the future. And he's already preparing the people for it. This is going to come, and you're going to find it difficult to deal with, but that's okay, because God has a bigger plan. And God is going to bring you through this. And in fact, he names the one who's going to bring them through it. Several times in Isaiah, Cyrus the Great is called by name. Cyrus the Persian, who is actually going to be the one responsible, the human responsible anyway, for bringing Judah back from Babylonian captivity. In our passage here in Isaiah 46, he's called a bird of prey in verse number 11. And similar language is found elsewhere. That this mighty eagle or vulture or whatever bird of prey you want to choose, I suppose, is going to be able to pick this nation up from its new home in Babylonia and carry it back to its land where it originally came from and allow it to establish itself again. This is all part of God's plan. And of course, the greater picture is this restoration is symbolic of a spiritual restoration that's going to be seen in the nation in subsequent years, and especially leading up to the time that the Messiah is going to come. And of course, Isaiah has a great deal to say about that as the text develops. In fact, we're kind of right in the middle of a big messianic heavy section here. Chapter 42, the servant of God is introduced. Chapter 49, we find out more about him. Chapter 53, of course, we find out how he suffers. We know that text fairly well. What I'd like to do is focus on chapter 46 here and look at some lessons that we can take from this text about God's purpose being established. This was the phrase that jumped out at me that in verse number 10, how he's declaring the end from the beginning, and more about this in a second. From ancient times, things that had not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all of my good pleasure. Now, we talked this morning in our Bible class out in the auditorium about planning and about how the future is not in our hands, and we should say, if the Lord wills, we shall both live and do such and such, as James says in James chapter 4. God does not work under the same constraints that we do, obviously. God is not captured by time. He is not powerless in certain areas or any area, as far as that goes. And so therefore, he can speak with authority here and says that my will is going to be established. And if we are on the side of God, that should give us a tremendous source of encouragement and lighten our load considerably to know that God is going to do the things that he has set out to do. And if we can just be a part of that, if we can allow him to have his way with us, we can allow him to take us to a place where we would like to be, and that'll have the blessings that we are hoping that are going to be ours in subsequent days, both in this life and in the life to come. Why is it that it's going to be established? Why is it that we can have this kind of confidence? Why is it that God has this kind of confidence and tries to instill it in us? That's what I want to focus on here a little bit this evening. And I'm going to give you several sub-points that are found in the text. The first one is because God is the same. Look back at verse number 3 and 4. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You have been born by me from birth and have been carried from the womb. Even to your old age, I will be the same. And into your graying years, I will bury you. I have done it. I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you. There's some pregnancy imagery that we find it here in this text. Those of you who have been pregnant or have had your hands broken in the delivery room by a woman who was pregnant, you can appreciate this a little bit. There is a finality, a certainty behind all of this. This is going to come to pass. It's going to reach its intended destination. God has been birthing not just a physical nation, but also a spiritual nation, a spiritual hope, a plan that is much grander than any nation, even greater than the nation of Israel. And this goes back all the way to the beginning. All the way, in fact, it goes beyond the beginning. I was going to say it goes back to the days of Moses and Joshua, but it goes back further than that, really. It goes all the way back to Abraham. It goes all the way back to Adam. God has always had this plan in mind to bring his people into this great place, this marvelous place. And he is going to bring it to fruition. He is going to carry it to term, as it were. God at the creation, God at Sinai, is the same as God in the days of Hezekiah. The same as the God of the Israelites in Babylonia. The same as the God who brought Jesus into the world. The same God who exists today. Because God is the same, that he does not change, we can have confidence that the circumstances that exist at any given time in our life are irrelevant to the big picture. God is able to endure all of these things. He has established his will throughout time. And as we've talked about before, we can talk about some specifics, and I don't want to get too bogged down into this, because you know these stories. You know how God brought the flood into the world and showed the world about his judgment. You know how he brought the people out of Egypt through the Exodus. And again, it demonstrated himself to be who he was to his people and to us as well. He is going to, in the not too distant future, from Isaiah's perspective, show his power again in the captivity, taking his people out of their homeland, destroying the temple, and taking them off into captivity. This also is a demonstration of God's power and God's justice. It all works together within the character of God. And in the bigger picture, in the broader scope of the Old Testament, we see this messianic hope, this idea that Jesus is going to come into the world. He's not called Jesus in Isaiah. He's called various things, especially this word servant that comes up early on in the book. I'll refer you to one passage in Isaiah chapter 42 and verses 1 and following. Behold my servant, whom I uphold. He's the servant of God because he's going to accomplish God's purposes. He's going to carry out God's plan within time among his people. My servant, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. So here's what Jesus is going to do. And we understand, of course, this is talking about Jesus. That this is simply yet another, although the greatest, manifestation of God's involvement in the life of his people. Did God suddenly have concern for mankind in the first century? You know what? We've got a lot of lost people out here. I'd really rather them be saved people. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to send Jesus into the world to save their sins. That's not the way it happened. This was accomplished in the mind of God long before, and about the timelessness of God, we'll talk about that in a second.
This notion of God being the same, though. God existed back in the days of Adam and had a plan for mankind. Before he needed a plan for mankind, he had a plan. More on that as well. And sending Jesus into the world establishes the same principle for us in our lifetime. Notice as we go on in the text, in verse number 5 and following, back in our text in Isaiah 46. To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we would be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. They bow down, indeed they worship it. They lift it upon the shoulders and carry it. They set it in its place, and it stands there. It does not move from place to place. Though when they cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from his distress. Now, in our modern day, in American society today, in the 21st century, the notion of idolatry is very difficult to grasp. And that's a good thing, I suppose, because we have distanced ourselves from the notion of crafting a god out of things, out of created matter. Despite what the paleontologists will tell you, or the professors of Eastern civilizations and whatnot, idolatry was a learned behavior. This was something that developed out of monotheism. We know from the very beginning, the Bible teaches that the first human beings believed in one God. They did not worship with idols. They understood the oneness of God. Over the years, this changed. Whether it changed before the flood or not, I'm not sure the Bible actually says. But if it was after the flood, it didn't wait too long after the flood. Before too long, mankind was worshiping the creature rather than the creator. Should have known better. But nevertheless, this is what creation did. And God is trying to emphasize to his people who had far too much experience with idolatry, I am not like that. I'm not like this hunk of metal that is formed into something that looks impressive, or this piece of stone or wood or whatever it happens to be. Look at what happens with these idols. These idols are carried from place to place. They're stationary. On a good day, they're stationary. On a bad day, they'll fall over. That great story in the days of David, when the Ark of the Covenant, well, it's before the days of David, in the days of the Judges, when the Ark of the Covenant is taken into captivity and it's placed in front of the Philistine god Dagon, the idol Dagon, and they wake up the next day and the idol's knocked over. And then they put it upright and the next day it's knocked over and broken. You know, it's what's happening here. Something's going on with this. Well, I guess they didn't have Gorilla Glue back then. You know, they just didn't have it locked in place enough, maybe. Well, no, maybe it's just that it's not a god, and it was subject to the whim of the one who is the god. The God that we serve, the God that is real, is unlike the idols that we're dealing with in the days of Isaiah. He does not need the help that we want to offer these idols, or that they wanted to offer these idols. Paul makes this point in Acts chapter 17, verse 24 and 25, that he's not served by human hands in the same sense that we serve these idols, as though he needed anything. He's not like that. He doesn't need our help. He asks for our help, but it's not because he's short somehow, because he's incompetent or powerless. It's because he chooses to beckon us into his presence. He doesn't need us to make him any greater than he is, as if that were possible at all. He doesn't need our help to be glorious. And we can turn to any number of passages, especially in the Psalms, to deal with this. Psalm 108, verse 5 is one that is a favorite among hymn writers. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Lifting him up, glorifying him. This is what we do as human beings. But hopefully we understand this is not for the purpose of making him greater than he is. This is for the purpose of helping other people who may not be informed to be told of how wonderful he is, and to remind those of us who do know how wonderful he is. Because we can forget sometimes. We can absolutely take the God that we serve for granted. This powerful God, this real God, is one that can be counted on, one that can be relied upon. Well, what happens if you move? You know, this God may work for you in Texas, but what happens if you move to Florida? Well, as it happens, nothing happens. You're going to be fine, because this God is mobile. This, again, was another misconception among the pagan tribes. Well, you know, our God's God of the valleys and their God is God of the mountains. So we fight in the mountains and they win, and we fight in the valleys and we win. Well, it may be that you won a victory in one place and you won a victory in another place. But it's not because God was present in one place and not present in another. That's not what happened. This God that we have travels. In fact, Psalm 139, you know the text in verse 7 and following. Shall I go here? No, you're there. Over here, you're there. And in the context of Psalm 139, that's a good thing. Now, it may not be a good thing if you are in rebellion against this God. If you're like Jonah, you're trying to get on a boat and get away from God, you're going to meet with some opposition with that. God is on all the continents. He's on all the seas. He's under the sea, at the top of the mountains. You cannot go anywhere to flee from the presence of God. And again, for the people of God, for us, that is a wonderful thing. Because we don't have to worry about somehow excavating this idol of ours and putting it in our station wagon and hauling it off to our next location. That's not what we have to do. Our God is already there. And if we decide to move ourselves for whatever reason, God is going to be able to move with us. And standing in one place. Equally important. Job says, that great text that's been turned into a song or two in our hymnals as well. I know that my Redeemer lives, and the last he will take a stand upon the earth. God is going to take his stand on the earth. He is going to be where he needs to be. He's going to fight the battle that he needs to fight. It may or may not be in accordance with your priorities or your timetable or whatever. Job would have liked God to show up a little earlier, if you know the story about Job. Nevertheless, he is coming. He will take his stand. And we can have confidence that this God is going to be there when he needs to be there, where he needs to be. And to respond as well. You know, if he moves into the right place and stands in the right place, it doesn't do a whole lot of good if he doesn't do anything when he's there. But we are told that we serve a God that actually acts and acts over and over again. Again, any number of passages will do to illustrate this. But I refer you to Jeremiah chapter 29, verse number 12 and following. And in fact, you can back up a little bit. Back up to verse number 10, because this fits in with the overall thought of the captivity and the return. Jeremiah, writing a century or so after Isaiah, after some of these things have begun to be accomplished, he writes, "For thus says the Lord, when 7 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you." This is the word of God, of course. "And fulfill my word, my good word to you, to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. And I will restore your fortunes and will gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I've driven you, declares the Lord. And I will bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile." Now, we have a role in this. We have to seek for God. But he says, if you do, I will let you find me. And I will be there to help you. I'll be there to lift you up. And you can see that in a specific context like Jeremiah and his life and the life of the generation to come. Or you can see it in a more broad context of the people of God who find themselves in times of trouble, who find themselves struggling, who find themselves hurting, who occasionally question in their mind whether God is really active, whether he's really present at all. But when we reach down, we find our faith and we continue to seek after him, we can have confidence that he will, in fact, be there. Now, the idol's not as much. Again, you remember the story in 1 Kings chapter 18, where Elijah tries to set up a contrast, and does, between worship of the one true God and worship of Baal. And the idol prophets are doing all kinds of crazy stuff, right? All day long, dancing around and swinging their arms and yelling and screaming and cutting themselves and doing all kinds of histrionics to try to get the attention of their God, who Elijah suggests maybe just kind of asleep, or maybe on vacation. Maybe he's in the bathroom. Maybe he just needs to yell a little bit louder. It's, you know, keep it up. Keep it up. Maybe he'll listen to you the next time. Our God didn't like that. Our God is always there for us. Our God is always listening and eager to respond to us when we reach out to him in trusting and obedient faith, not like the idols. Now, getting kind of to the heart of it here, the reason that God's will is going to be established in a very real sense is because it has already been established. And I mean that in a couple of different ways. It has been established over and over and over again as God's will has changed from generation to generation, from situation to situation. God manifested his will at the creation, at Sinai, at the flood, at the Exodus, during the days of Jesus. All of this was a demonstration of God's will. And God has continually done these things, and God is a God that does not change, and so therefore it can be reasonably assumed that he will continue to establish his will. But there's a deeper reality here. It's not just that God has done all these things in the past. There is a sense in which, and this kind of boggles the human mind, there is a sense in which God has already done these things in the future. At least what we would call the future. Now, I'm not mixing my tenses here. I'm speaking deliberately here. There is a sense, at least, in which these things that God does for us in the future, what he has planned for us within our life, and especially after this life is over, that they have already been done in the mind of God. Now, they've obviously not been done within our lifetimes. That's what the future is. We're not talking about time machines here. But God does not need a time machine because God does not live within time. Look at what he writes here in verse number 8 and following. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things, long past. Some of the things we were talking about. For I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done, saying my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Again, that's Cyrus. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. Now go back to the phrase there in verse number 10. I have this underlined in my Bible to kind of remind me about these things. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done. Again, maybe a couple of ways of looking at this. Certainly there is any number of examples that we could talk about where God predicted the future through his prophets. Or maybe it'd be better to say his prophets predicted the future through God. Either way. But there is also a sense in which the things that are not yet done are still accomplished in the mind of God. He knows these things already. He says something similar in Romans chapter 4. And about verse 17, if I can get there, Romans chapter 4, and back into verse 16. For this reason it is by faith, this salvation that we are being granted, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants, not only those who are of the law, that is, the Jewish Christians, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all, the father of all the faithful, regardless of their lineage. As it is written, verse 17, a man of many nations have I made you, in the presence of him whom he had believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. Abraham knew about this better than most. For 25 years, Abraham sojourned in the land of Canaan, having been told he was going to have a son. And not only that he was going to have a son, but the son would himself have children. And that, as it says here, he would be a father of many nations because of that child. And it's not that he was promised when he was 6 years old and he got married when he was 25 and he had the kid at 30. That's not the way it worked. He received this promise when he was 75. Which and ages didn't mean quite the same thing as they do now, that people tended to live a lot longer back then. But even so, 75, no offense to those who are 75 and older, but that's not typically when you start planning a family. And when time stretches past 75 to 80, 85, 90, 95, you start to wonder about this. Maybe, and Abraham and Sarah did. Maybe God meant something else. Maybe we need to tweak this plan a little bit. But faith succeeds in all of these things. Faith enables us to believe in a God who accomplishes things, impossible things, and speaks of them as though they've already been done. Any number of prophecies can be said along the same way. But we can take comfort in our own lives that there are certain realities about serving God, certain realities about being His children that we have not seen accomplished yet, but God has. Because of His timeless nature, because He does not live hour to hour, minute to minute in the same way that we do, He has a victory that He has already accomplished in His mind that we have yet to see, but nevertheless is real and will be accomplished in us. Each of us in his own order, the text says in verse number 23. We'll get back to verse 22. As in Adam all die, so also in Christ all will be made alive. It's done as far as God is concerned. He is the future tense here for our purposes. But this is not a provisional plan that hopefully is going to come together if all the stars align and all that kind of thing. This is done, he says. Just waiting on the last enemy to be put under his feet, which is death itself. In verse number 26. God is victorious over his enemies. Is, present tense. I realize it doesn't always look that way. On a minute-to-minute basis in your own life, maybe it isn't that way. But we can have confidence because God has confidence, because who God is, that the victory that has not yet been realized in the flesh, hasn't been accomplished in history, has been accomplished outside of history in the mind of God. The same thing goes for our own salvation. The glories that are waiting for us after this life is over are already accomplished. Now, I don't know if that means that heaven is under construction now or it's already finished or exactly how that works. God will work all that out. The important thing for our purposes is this, that God is going to bring this to a conclusion. He who sits on the throne, verse number 5, Jesus himself says, "Behold, I am making all things new." And he said, "Write, for these words are faithful and true." Then he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." The beginning and the end, the Alpha and Omega. It is done, he says. And I don't think it just means that John is being given a glimpse at the last page in the book. I think it's bigger than that. I think what he's saying here is that God has accomplished this reality already. And it's only a matter of who is going to be in that select company. Whether God wins this battle, whether his people are going to survive, whether they are going to be glorified is a given. As is the flip side to that, the doom of the sinner. That has been spoken from the beginning, going all the way back to Adam. In the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Well, Adam ate and he didn't die. So was God a liar? No. It's just death is more involved thing than that. You can look at it again from a spiritual perspective or a physical perspective. From a spiritual perspective, Adam died in the sense that he was separated from God. The sin that he had chosen for himself, that Eve chose for herself, came between them and God, made a separation that they themselves were powerless to overcome. That spiritual life that they enjoyed in paradise was severed, gone for the rest of their lives. And so in that sense, they died spiritually. But I'll tell you, they died physically too. If Adam had faith, like I trust that he did, he realized, as did Eve, that when God spoke the word of death to him, it was now just a matter of living his years out. Death was already in him. Death was in the world. It had already been accomplished. Now, Adam lived to be 930 years old. How many of those happened before the fall? We don't know. Maybe none of them did. Maybe none of them counted before the fall. I don't know. Text doesn't say. But I think most of us would probably assume it's probably closer to the zero end than the 930 end. Although, again, the text doesn't say. How powerful is it that we can look at the Word of God who speaks, in that day you're going to die. And then it happens. It takes 900 years to happen in our time. But it's every bit as real on that first day, that last day in the garden, as it was on the day that Adam passed from this life. When God speaks doom to the sinner, and we could turn to some references, we're not going to do that. We're going to wrap things up. But you know the text as well as I do. God says those who choose sin over righteousness will perish. It's already done. It's not a matter of getting up to heaven and figuring out you can somehow cut a deal or whatever. No, it's over. Now, the great thing about the salvation process that is available to us through Jesus is that anybody who is in this category, the last category here, the one that are doomed by sin, anyone in this category can move into the other category and be one of the saved people. Anybody can do that. You can do that. And vice versa, by the way. And it's just as certain as anything else God ever told you. This is how we can have confidence that God is going to establish his will. This is why we know about heaven and hell. This is why we know about salvation. This is how we know about Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Because these things have already been done. And the great thing about it is that we can, in fact, look at the last page of the book. We can be assured of how things are going to turn out. And all we have to do is be on the right side. You know, some of the politicians these days like talking about being on the right side of history. I'm curious how people know what the right side of history is. You know, 20 years from now, we're going to look back on this, and you're going to realize that you weren't on the right side of history. Well, I don't know what time machine you're driving, but that's not really the way it works in human terms. God's terms are different, though. You can be on the right side or the wrong side of history, as far as God's concerned, because God already knows the end. And he tells you, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. If you walk orderly, if you walk righteously, walk in faith, you can and you will be saved. It's already done as far as God's concerned. On the other hand, if you choose another lifestyle, you've already been condemned. Jesus talks about that. The one who chooses sin is dead already. So make sure that you're on the right side of this, is what we're basically saying as we wrap these things up. Are you one of the saved people or are you one of the lost people? And don't think so much in terms of being saved today or being lost today. Think about eternity. If you are not within the confines of the grace that's available in Jesus Christ, you are not just lost today, you're lost eternally. You don't have to stay that way, though. You can accept Jesus. You can put him on in baptism. You can have your sins washed away. You can return to the faith that you may be abandoning. You can heighten your connection to God and know that these things that he's promised to his people are going to be yours whenever time runs out in God's mind. That's why we want to offer you an invitation to make your life right with God in whatever way you may need to. If you need to be baptized, if you need to confess a fault that you have committed, maybe a public indiscretion that you need to help with the church with, you need to confess to your brethren, help us pray for you, pray with you, whatever your need happens to be. We want you to be on the right side of history. And more importantly, we want you to be on the right side of eternity. And if we can help in that regard, please respond to the invitation at this time while we stand and sing at this time.